Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonya Rappaport.
And today we are discussing the Phoenix Saga, Part 4, The Starjammers. We are still in the third season. This is the sixth episode of that season and the 32nd episode overall.
And Part 4 of 5 of the Phoenix Saga.
That's right. We are almost done with Phoenix Month.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of Phoenix Month, Sonya, how have you been enjoying your Phoenix Month thus far?
I love Phoenix Month. It's the best.
Oh, yeah? What activities have you been doing to celebrate it?
Summoning firebirds.
Really? Wow. Yeah. I got a haircut yesterday.
Shooting into outer space.
I got a haircut and you've been shooting into outer space. I see.
Yeah, we all celebrate Phoenix Month in our own way.
I see that. Very interesting. I've also been watching a lot of Star Trek, as we mentioned a few episodes ago.
That's actually true. Actually, you know, it's funny because, like, there are some parallels there between the Phoenix episodes and the Star Trek episodes that you've been watching.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I never really watched Star Trek before. I had seen, you know, the new J.J. Abrams movies and maybe a few episodes of the original series with William Shatner, you know, here or there for fun.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm more of a Star Wars guy. I don't like Star Trek.
Yeah.
But then for whatever reason, we started watching Star Trek The Next Generation on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. And then you got sucked right in.
Yeah, we got really sucked in. And we've also been mixing in episodes of Star Trek Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, you're right. It's actually, it's not just the X-Men. It's like so much of all science fiction medium is either influenced or pulled or reminiscent of Star Trek. So
in some ways, like right. The setting is the same because they've got their spaceships and, you know, they can beam from one place to another and mm-hmm. like all that stuff by, you know, different media.
And there's inexplicably humans in other parts of the galaxy.
Right. But I would say that Star Trek is a much more boring plotline type of show than X-Men. I mean, that's kind of the lore of Star Trek, is that like the whole like pace and tone of it is very calm,
right?
And they have like long philosophical debates,
right,
about like, are androids human and do they have, right, emotions and like, or you know, like
the X-Men,
they get into it, whereas X-Men, right, is very soap opera-y.
Right. Yeah, it's a little, the X-Men's a little more action-packed and a lot more soap opera-y. The interpersonal interactions with all the X-Men characters,
it's much more overt and loud.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the characters are really in your face in X-Men, which is great.
Right.
It's like the ultimate, it's one of the ultimate Marvel expressions, the
yeah,
X-Men.
Totally. I just think it's so funny because, like, watching these Star Trek episodes, it's kind of like I could tune out and tune back in,
yeah,
like 10 minutes at a time, and it doesn't really make a difference. They have like long pauses where like the camera goes from one person's face to another, and there's no dialogue for like an uncomfortable length of time.
Yeah, because people are thinking on screen,
right? So I guess it makes me appreciate these X-Men episodes even more.
Really?
Yeah.
But that's not to denigrate Star Trek, though.
No.
We've been enjoying it.
Yeah.
It's been a silly, fun time.
Yeah, but it's nice to have a little contrast, I guess.
That's true. But enough about Star Trek. Let's get back to Phoenix Month.
All right.
So this episode, let's recap what happened in the last episode. The last episode we saw our old pal Juggernaut, we were introduced to Black Tom, and Banshee fought alongside the X-Men, and basically the Phoenix arrived, Jean Grey, to save the day at the end of the episode. She sort of vanquished, Gladiator vanquished Juggernaut, and then Jean Grey vanquished Gladiator, who's one of the Imperial Shi'ar Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jean sort of said, like, you know, we have to protect the crystal, I'm the one to do it. And, they also save Lilandra.
Right.
The space alien who has a bond deeper than love with Professor X.
Right.
So that's sort of where we are. And the episode opens up on Cassidy Keep, which is Banshee's ancestral familial castle. Just a few funny little details right away. When this episode opens, something I had no memory of, you see Black Tom running away in the foreground there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of funny. He's really hightailing it after his entire scheme has fallen apart. I wonder if he was able to pocket that $10 million. It didn't look like it because they showed the $10 million in the previous episode, and it took up, it was like an enormous stack of money.
Uh-huh.
I guess it was all in, well, even if it was all in hundreds, I feel like that would be more than a briefcase size. And so he has to run away without his money, poor Black Tom. And then we also see the Eric the Red's spaceship fly away too.
Right.
So all the villains from the previous episode are leaving the stage.
They're dispersing, yeah.
And we are, and then out of nowhere, the Blackbird arrives. Beast, Cyclops, and Storm, who were all in New York.
They join the team.
They join the team. So now the X-Men are fully assembled.
Mm-hmm.
And so here Jean lays out the stakes of what's going on. She says that they have to prepare for a battle that's going to decide the fate of the galaxy. And she says something like, and this is one of my favorite quotes, and then, well, the favorite part's the reaction quote coming up, but I'll read it to you. So Jean says, "In our hands lies the fate of a billion star systems, of lives beyond measure."
And then Gambit replies to her, "Oh, just what I wanted to hear."
Which, I like how we inverted the genders of reading these lines.
Yeah, not on purpose, but there it goes.
Right. But that's, I love that line in that moment because, first of all, it's really funny. And second of all, it just, Gambit's reminding the audience that the X-Men are, despite the fact that they're super-powered superheroes, that the thought of saving the galaxy or that all the lives in the galaxy are in their hands makes him especially rather queasy, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's like one of those lines where it's like true because, like, of course they're going to jump to action and, like, save all these people, but also not true because it's like a really daunting task, you know?
Right. Well, this isn't the first time Gambit's expressed hesitation about saving the day. There's that episode when they had to go fight the Sentinels.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a suicide mission.
Right.
And they had to take on Master Mold, and Gambit did not want to risk his life and all the mutants' lives for the sake of Senator Kelly.
Well, that's just, like, the setup with a lot of these X-Men episodes. It seems like they're up against, like, insurmountable odds, and yet they still go do it, and that's what makes them superheroes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I just think it's interesting that Gambit's the voice of hesitation in the group. He's, like, the reluctant hero. He doesn't really want to be. He gets annoyed when the X-Men have to expand their daily superhero activities to something a little more epic.
I don't think he's really reluctant. I mean, he goes to do it. I think he's. It's just like, well, his sense of humor coming out, right? Like,
well, it's both his sense of humor, but at the same time, I think he feels like it needs to be said.
Uh huh.
I don't know. I just found it. It's just one of my favorite lines in the show. Perhaps my favorite line ever.
Wow.
Yeah. I just think it's, I just like the way, it's just very, it's very human.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like about the X-Men. Despite their soap opera-ness and their, you know, larger-than-life, in-your-face attitude, they have extreme streaks of human behavior and lines like that, and I love it.
Yeah.
So, it's at this point, you know, Phoenix is preparing them to go on this mission, and she's, like, summoning her power, and because she's going to transport the X-Men to one of Lilandra's, like, spaceships that's flying around waiting for her that has the M-Kron crystal on it.
Mm-hmm.
So as she does this, we get another cameo time from the extended Marvel Universe. So we see that when the Phoenix uses her power, certain heroes around the world notice it. In England, we see Captain Britain, who's this British mutant that leads the spin-off X-Men team called Excalibur. So it's kind of cool to see him. We see the White Queen in the Hellfire Club. The White Queen's the telepath of that group. They're an evil group of mutants,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to see more of them later. And she sort of gets, like, the psychic powers of the Phoenix.
Her brain tingles.
Yeah, her brain hurts, right? And then lastly, we see the famous Doctor Strange, who can tell serious stuff is going down.
Yes.
So, in the question of, I mean, less so with Captain Britain, but in the question of Doctor Strange, you think this might be an opportunity for him to maybe join the fracas, so to speak.
Yeah.
That he would, you know, him being aware of this, he would probably think that he should take action. But alas, he's just a mere cameo in this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is almost like a weird byproduct of the time when Marvel had the ability to use all of its properties without, you know, this was before the era when Fox exclusively controlled X-Men and had no access to the other Marvel characters, you know, be they Avenger types or, you know, whoever they might be.
Right.
Although Captain Britain would probably fall in the Fox-controlled IP category because he's a mutant. So I guess Fox could make an Excalibur movie if they wanted to. Yeah. And they can certainly, and have used the White Queen and the Hellfire Club.
Yeah.
But Doctor Strange is a Marvel guy. So it's just, again, another reminder of what could be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Anyway, so Jean, you know, transports the X-Men to this ship, but it's interesting who she leaves behind. So she doesn't take everybody.
Right.
So she leaves behind Jubilee, Professor X, Banshee, Storm, and Moira MacTaggert. Well, Moira MacTaggert makes sense to leave behind. Right. She's just a human. Makes sense to leave Jubilee behind. She's just a teenager. It's too dangerous.
Right.
Makes less sense that Storm is left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe Storm can't summon the weather in outer space.
Right, there's no weather to summon, so...
Or it's like the question becomes, can Storm only manipulate Earth weather if she was on an alien planet?
Maybe she could manipulate alien weather, but in a spaceship in outer space, there's no weather, right?
There's an atmosphere.
No.
I mean, there's an artificial atmosphere, right?
No.
I mean, there's oxygen and...
Oh, like within the spaceship.
Right, yeah. So, I don't know. It's an interesting question. And is Storm left behind because she wouldn't be able to use her powers in the spaceship or in outer space, or because Jean is worried about her claustrophobia?
Or is it because Moira and Jubilee might need protecting back on Earth?
That's true. But then she also leaves Professor X behind.
Right.
And that, to me, seems like a mistake. He would be awfully useful on this mission, I would think.
Well, no, but he's still in a little bit incapacitated, right? Like, in the past couple episodes, they've been talking about how he's, like, kind of going off his rocker.
Yeah.
And his directions can't be trusted, and, like, there's stuff going on with him that he's being real mysterious about.
Yeah, but now everything's been revealed. Lalandra turned out to be real.
Right.
And he seems relatively okay. It doesn't seem like he's that hobbled. I mean, I guess that'd be the only excuse, that because his dark side was unleashed recently, that he can't really be... He's not 100% yet.
Right.
But still, I would think that the professor would be really useful in this mission to immediately, you know, mentally attack all the enemies and either incapacitate them in that way or mind control them.
Yeah. So. But he doesn't go along on a lot of the missions. Partly because he's wheelchair-bound, maybe, and, like...
I think the real reason is because it's what I just said. He's too powerful.
Uh-huh.
He could control everyone with his mind. So when you bring him on a mission, you're almost wondering why he's not doing anything if he's not, you know?
Hmm.
But then again, in this show, they never really present Professor X as that powerful anyway. He's always...
Right.
There's always something where he's, like, knocked out of his chair or easily manhandled or something happens to him.
Yeah, right.
Where he can't really dominate a situation like you think he might be able to.
Hmm.
So, and, you know, like we've talked about before, that's, like, one of the main tropes of the X-Men comics in general, is that Professor X is usually put out of the action.
Yeah.
Here, it's more convenient than anything else that he's left behind, and there's no explanation really offered why Jean takes who she takes. And the people she does take is, she takes Lalandra, Cyclops, Wolverine, Beast, Gambit, and Rogue. And I was thinking that it seems like a mistake to take Lalandra.
It's her ship, though, isn't it?
It is her ship, but yeah, I guess you need her to explain to her crew members, like, what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, who are these X-Men people? But at the same time, Lalandra seems awfully vulnerable to her brother, the Mad Emperor Deken.
But also, the whole mission here is protecting the Emkron crystal, which is the Phoenix's whole purpose, but it's also Lalandra's, like, purpose in life.
Well, not necessarily. Lalandra's purpose, she's the princess of the Shi'ar.
Or, like, it's her big mission right now. Like, it's the thing that she's most worried about.
Right.
So,
I mean,
it makes sense that she would be there to help protect it.
I know, but it's, as we'll see later, Lalandra's presence complicates things.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, okay. So that's who she takes. And it's here we get a little more information about this mysterious Emkron crystal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone's wondering, like, what the big deal about it is, and Beast, like, Gambit or Rogue asks, you know, how do you fit a whole galaxy in there? Which is a good question. And Beast somehow knows the answer. I don't know where he pulls this out of his butt, but he does. He says, its faceted configuration gives the crystal infinite storage capacity for refracted light energy. Sonia, please make sense of this.
Well, my favorite part of this is that right after he finishes saying that, Rogue goes, oh, I knew there had to be a simple explanation.
And then Gambit says something ridiculous. He's like, you like a chair? I'll get you one for Christmas.
Right.
So they're not taking this that seriously.
Yeah, seriously not.
But let's try to pull apart this insane sci-fi explanation of Beasts.
Okay.
So it's been told, it's been... let me just say this generally. It's been forewarned that that if the crystal is accessed or something, that the whole galaxy is endangered.
Uh-huh.
And maybe the galaxy next door to, the whole galactic neighborhood is in trouble if the crystal is breached.
Right.
And what, you know, basically, Daken wants the crystal to get power from it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what were you going to say? So that's something, that's the background of the crystal.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But Beast here is saying, in the answer to the question, you know, how can a whole galaxy fit in there?
Mm-hmm.
Then that's when he gives his whole, you know, response about that it has infinite storage capacity for refracted light energy.
Uh-huh.
So what's your interpretation of that?
Well, he's saying it's because it's faceted.
Right.
So because of the way the crystal is cut, it can absorb the light that hits it gets refracted, like, to the inside, uh-huh. I guess, like, right? Like, the light hits the surface, the facet of the crystal, it bends inward into the crystal, and then it doesn't escape again, and it can just absorb infinite amounts of light that refracts inside it.
So it's
that's the way that my brain interprets his response, which still doesn't make sense.
So basically what you're saying is that the crystal, like, no matter where it is in space, it's absorbing the entire totality of all light of
which
the galactic region.
Should be like a black hole, right?
Right. So
I don't know.
Is the crystal like, because we know in real science that the center of all galaxies are supermassive black holes.
Uh-huh.
So is the crystal somehow in lieu of this, or maybe that like what the X-Men universe is saying, that it's not so much a supermassive black hole at the heart of all galaxies, it's an Emkron crystal. And that if you are a spacefaringly technologically advanced society like the Shi'ar,
uh-huh.
you might just be able to pick it up or something and put it in your temple, your ancient temple.
Maybe.
And protect it.
Well, all you physicists out there, if you have a different, smarter interpretation, please let us know.
I mean, I don't know. It makes no sense that it would be a physical object.
No.
That could, like, fit in somebody's purse.
Nope.
So that's what the Emkron crystal is. The X-Men have to protect it. It just seems awfully dangerous that such an object even exists in the first place.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about the crystal later on as the episode, as we explain what's going on in this episode. There's another little funny moment worth mentioning. Jean has a line saying, we must move quickly to safeguard the crystal, and it's clearly Jean's face enunciating this line.
Yeah.
But it's Lalandra's voice.
Uh-huh.
So that is some kind of animation error, or...
Or is it that she's channeling Lalandra or something?
I don't think it's that. I think it's clearly just a mistake. Yeah,
error.
I mean, the X-Men show is rife with animation errors and mistakes like this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's happened in a previous episode before where a dialogue between Wolverine and Sabretooth get mixed up, and they're in like a fight, and you know Wolverine says Sabretooth's dialogue or vice versa. I forget what exactly.
Yeah.
So it's happened again.
Yeah. All right. That's
and,
so bad.
And you know, and it's like not just audio errors. There's a lot of animation errors where, like even in this episode, we see Gambit light up one of his cards and it glows green.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, you know, it's not supposed to glow green.
It's supposed to be red. Yeah.
Right. Unless that's something new that we don't know about Gambit.
Right.
Maybe in outer space's cards glow green.
Right. I'll just say again that I miss the voice modulation that they had on Lalandra in that first episode.
Right, yeah.
And they dropped since.
That is such a mistake.
It made it like a little less obvious that this animation error happened, so maybe that was in their favor.
Yeah.
But it was really cool and like made her more of like an outer space woman.
Yeah, when she has the voice. So when we first meet Lilandra, she's got a cool voice modulation effect on her voice.
Yeah.
But then in the next episode, they quickly get rid of it and she's just normal.
Yeah, wonder why.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. Because, right, that was a really cool touch. Anyway, Lilandra's ship, and this is all going on in our local solar system, it's attacked by the Starjammers. So now here we meet the Starjammers, the name of this episode. So the Starjammers are led by this guy named Corsair. On this particular incarnation of the team, he has a dude named Raza.
Oh, it's Corsair? I thought it was Corsair.
I think actually you're right, Corsair. Oh. It's pronounced Corsair. I don't know. I don't know how it's spelled, though. I think it might be spelled Corsair and pronounced Corsair. Whatever. I'm going to mess up the pronunciation.
Okay. So,
you're just going to have to live with that. So he's got this one guy in a ship named Raza. He looks like a piratey man with a weird ponytail on his head.
An eye patch.
Yeah. But does he have an eye patch?
Doesn't he?
I don't know. I don't remember. And then we've got this cat lady named Hepzah. How do you pronounce it? Hepzah.
Hezbazah,
yes. That's like an Egyptian name, isn't it?
I don't know.
Isn't that like an Egyptian, of Egyptian lore, that name?
No idea.
Hezbazah, right? Did I pronounce it right?
I think so. Man, we're doing a bad job with these star jammers.
Yeah, and then we'll get a load of the next guy. And then there's this other guy, he's like a large lizard man. His name is Cha'od.
Uh-huh.
Or Chode. It's spelled Ch'od.
Let's say Chod.
Chod, not Chode.
I really don't know.
And not Cha'od or Cha'od.
Lizard man.
Yeah, okay, lizard man. He's got like some kind of weird pet on his shoulder too.
It's like a space parrot.
Right, yeah.
I like that little touch.
It's right. Funny. Looks like kind of like the Porg character they're going to introduce in the new Star Wars movie.
Mm-hmm.
The new marketing gimmick, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, but it's because they're pirates, right? So like Raza has his eye patch thing and then...
Right, yeah.
Lizard man.
Yeah, that's what the Starjammers are, in case you're lost here. They're space pirates.
Right.
An inexplicable group of space pirates. And this is very Star Trek-y, very Firefly-esque, the TV show, you know. Yeah.
So, like, all these people that they're encountering in outer space, like, none of them are really a uniform species, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm. They're not, like, these are not Shi'ar pirates.
Here's what I was wondering about them, is, like, it's not just the pirates, it's, like, some other characters mm-hmm. we're going to meet
the Imperial Guard all mixed up.
But, like, is it that they are mutants that happen to be from outer space, or does mutation have nothing to do with it, and they... each are from, like, a different alien species?
Well,
is it that alien species just are, like, a lot more varied than humans are?
Well, this speaks to your natural human bias, Sonya.
Uh-huh.
Because, and it speaks to the heart of the debate in the X-Men show,
uh-huh.
is that, I mean, are the mutants not human beings? They are. They're humans. They're just...
No,
their DNA is different.
That's not the root of my question.
It's that humans, they miscategorize people different as a whole other different class or group.
Right.
Much as the way of how we have racism in the real world. And
right.
We distinguish... Even if you're not racist, we still... In human language, in the course of human description, we describe other people of different races. You know, it's like, oh, they're of the Asian race, or they're of the African race.
Uh-huh.
And that in itself isn't racist, but in a sense it is, ultimately. In a real, like, you know, spirit brotherhood of sisterhood of the world picture, it's like, uh-huh. there are no real races. It's just, you know, people are from different regions, and they have different characteristics.
Right.
We're all genetically human beings.
Right.
You know, there's no, like, real difference between anybody.
Uh-huh.
So, if you expand that further, you could say the same about mutants. Mutants were born of humans.
Yeah.
Their DNA is just altered differently or something.
Right.
So, in an alien society... to answer your question, it's like, are these people mutants? Not necessarily. They're just either they're different species or they're just, you know, they just have different characteristics.
Well, here's the reason I'm asking the question is because I want to know how to picture all these different like planets
right.
in our galaxy. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
in this universe, like if I were to land on any one planet that's not Earth,
and
that's,
by the
like,
way, there's
inhabited.
Billions, but beyond measure, but
billions. Yes, any one of those billions of planets. It's like, does this universe conceive of those planets as being like as uniform as Earth, or is it that, like, they're conceiving of each planet having multiple intelligent life forms of different species?
Well,
or, like, how infinite is the gamut of, like, intelligent life in the universe?
Well, how uniform is Earth? What's so uniform about Earth?
Because we only have one intelligent species.
One intelligent species, yeah. But who's to say that on a planet similar to Earth, the humans would be intelligent, plus all the dolphins and deer.
That's what I'm wondering, yeah.
So, I mean, that could very well be the case. Yeah, of course, why not? So but that doesn't make Earth uniform. It just means that only one species achieved intelligence as far as we know.
I'm saying the intelligent species of Earth is pretty uniform, right? Like, in comparison to the lizard people and the cat people of the universe, yeah. Like, we all look pretty much the same on Earth.
Right.
Like, of intelligent beings.
Okay.
Know what I mean?
Right.
So, what I'm wondering is, like, the X-Men got into outer space because they're mutants, and they have, like, a wide range of powers, and they look different from, like, your average Earth human, some of them, and like that, right?
Yeah.
So, like, these alien people, aliens that are like on these space missions, are they the outliers of their planet? Are they also like different and special, and that's how they got into outer space? Or is it just the norm that like any old cat lady and lizard man would be like riding around the universe in a spaceship?
I mean,
that's where they're at.
It's here we have to turn to Star Trek.
Right.
So we've got a huge galaxy, and it's populated with billions of planets and worlds, lives beyond measure. And, you know, just because you see a cat lady and a lizard man, there's probably a whole planet of cat ladies or lizard men.
But can you assume that?
I mean, you can assume anything. You can assume any infinite combination almost, where it's maybe the planet is cat ladies and lizard men.
Yeah.
And, or maybe, you know, like one planet is cat ladies, or maybe the cat lady's from a planet where she's like a genetic experiment, and she's like the only one of her kind.
Right, so that's what I'm wondering. Do you know the background of these characters?
I mean, no, I don't. You're calling me out on my lack of Star Jammer knowledge.
Possibilities, so
yeah, like, well, but that's the whole point.
Cool to think about.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. This is like this is the X-Men in space.
Yeah,
and you know anything goes. You know, it's not like nothing. The parameters when the Star Jammers were introduced in the comic books. And this is what I'm basing my knowledge on. It was just random.
Uh-huh.
There was no, like, pre-established worlds where it was all divided up. You know, this is in section subspace Z of the Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. This is where the cat people live. And no, and here's a character from that. And it's not like Marvel established all that.
Uh-huh.
It was all just made-up nonsense.
Right.
And so, while on one hand I feel bad that I don't know, like, all the Star Jammers, like, histories and where the planets are from, and I'm sure that a lot of the backstory has been written.
Yeah.
I think that, like, in the spirit of the original comics as I read them, there was no, like, backstory that was of any note.
Okay.
So any subsequent, like, filling in of knowledge, you just have to have read every comic or read, like, a Marvel encyclopedia where some nerd was given the task of, like, coming up with the backstory. So, okay. So in a sense,
sorry,
you know,
I didn't mean to make you feel inadequate in your knowledge of Star Jammers.
No, that's fine. But, you know, but it's just, like, it's with any, like, nerd universe that, you know, they introduce concepts, alien species things, and they're usually just introduced for narrative purposes and
yeah.
for an interesting story. It's only later on, and you know, it's just a large testament to the success of these comics and concepts,
right.
that people go in and they come up with a more interesting backstory. Because after all, it's like, you know, it's like you need a new comic book or something. It's like, let's explore Hezbollah's backstory and
right,
see
yeah.
where she's from. So then you just come up with it there.
Right. And the reality is that, like, any of the answers to my question are, like, equally interesting. Like, if she is an outlier or
right.
if she is one of, you know, billions of cat people that all look the same or what, like, any of it is, like, interesting, you know, so yeah. it doesn't really make a difference.
I mean, her behavior in this episode raises a lot of questions. Because, like, at one point she makes out with Corsair
uh-huh.
and that's, like, why would a cat lady even think to want to make out with a human being?
Well.
Right. I mean, it's like, that's an interesting question. It's not, I'm not saying that it shouldn't happen.
Uh-huh.
I'm just saying that you would equally think that two alien species would have no desire to,
like, romantic interest in each other.
To express their emotions in the way humans express their
yeah.
love feelings.
Uh-huh.
So, and like, you don't know, even know why she's doing it. Maybe she's just doing it because she thinks, like, that's what humans like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Actually, she seems to, like, appear to blush after she does it in a way, too. To
more human than cat, perhaps.
Right. So who knows what's going on? Remember, X-Men in space!
Yeah, yeah.
So where were we?
Let's get back on track.
Right. So the Starjammers, they've sort of been introduced. They start fighting with the X-Men. And what happens is the Starjammers incapacitate Lalandra's ship with some kind of energy beam. It knocks everyone out, but only temporarily, because it was only meant to knock out Shi'ar people. And so the X-Men recover fairly quickly from this. But, like, they do manage to kidnap Cyclops and the M-Kron crystal from Lalandra's ship.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolverine's like, why did they do this to Jean? And Jean's like, I can't tell you why they took Cyclops. And Wolverine just walks away. He's like, okay. And then she sort of says to herself, because he's Cyclops' father.
Yeah.
And that's
a big reveal. I really don't understand why she couldn't tell him that. Why are we keeping these secrets,
Well, Jean, again, she has precedent for keeping secrets. In the previous episode, when we meet Cable and she reads Cable's mind, she discovers that Cable is the son of Cyclops and Jean.
Right.
And Scott's like, what happened, Jean? Why are you acting so weird? And she's like, I can't tell you.
Is it like a privacy thing? Like a patient confidentiality sort of thing?
I think it's half that. It's half patient confidentiality. And the other half is, like, the news is so mind-blowing to Jean that she doesn't even feel like it's her place to share these tidbits.
It's just a shame because, like, with her mind-reading capabilities, she should realize that Cyclops and Corsair both don't realize that they're related to each other.
Right.
And so, like, it could really just prevent a lot of misunderstandings if she was like, hey, guys, that's your dad. That's your son.
But like, it's also a Back to the Future scenario where it's like if you – and I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but – there's a reason why you don't tell people you meet, like, you're going to be the president or you're my mom one day.
But it's not like she's doing some time travel reveal.
I know, but it's like something, it's like where it's news that's so upsetting to characters that it might colossally destabilize.
Because they're on a mission here and she can't risk it?
I guess. I mean, yes. She's not worried about destabilizing the timeline. She's worried about destabilizing the narrative, I guess. Okay. People are going to have way more questions than she's going to be able to answer in that moment.
Right.
So, right, but she is keeping secrets, and it seems to be part of her character, in a sense.
Yeah.
She has a lot of secrets to keep. She's much like Rose from Titanic, in that a woman's heart is a chamber of secrets, which always makes me wonder what secrets you're hiding from me on a daily basis.
That saying always makes me wonder what a man's heart is.
It's an open book. We'll tell you everything.
It's a chained vault of secrets.
So Cyclops is kidnapped by the Starjammers along with the crystal, and then we cut to Emperor Deken and what he's up to, and it's a Gladiator and Eric the Red are flying back to the Emperor to report that they've totally failed, and Deken is quite upset. He's sort of yelling at them, but they do explain to him that the Guardian of the Phoenix, the Guardian of the Crystal is the Phoenix, and that's why they failed. And everyone's sort of stunned by this news, and at this point, Corsair contacts the Emperor with a deal. And his deal is like, I'll give you the crystal. I've also managed to capture the people that thwarted Gladiator and Eric the Red. I'll give you one of those guys, too, as a token, which turns out to be Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
All I want from you is half the Imperial Treasury. Which is a funny concept to imagine, that here's a civilization that controls a galaxy, and they have a treasury, and imagine what half of that is worth. Space bucks, you know, that's a South Park reference. I don't know if you'd get that. You're not the biggest South Park fan.
Mm-mm.
Anyway, and then the Emperor swears on the sacred oath of the Shi'ar ancestors that he'll agree to this.
Right.
And then he quickly tells Gladiator and his team, which is the Imperial Guard, he's like, when Corsair arrives, I want you to take the crystal and kill them all. And Gladiator is quite shocked by this. He's like, but Emperor, you swore the sacred oath.
Yeah, he's like, just do it.
And yeah.
Gladiator's like, oh, all right.
Welcome to politics, Gladiator.
Yeah.
Yes. You naive idiot. Gladiator, you ignorant slut. To quote SNL. Anyway, so that's what's going on there. And then here, Corsair reveals to Cyclops, he's like, guess what? I'm not really going to give the Emperor the crystal. I know it's really dangerous. I would never do such a thing. I hate the Emperor because he killed my wife a long time ago. By the way, I'm a human being. And by the way, Cyclops, I want you to be the one to kill the Emperor. He'll never suspect it, which makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
That he would never suspect that Cyclops could kill him. or would kill him.
Right.
But anyway, that's Co-Seer's plan. And Cyclops is like, I won't kill anyone in cold blood. And the Emperor's, not the Emperor, Co-Seer's like, it's like, you'd really have your morals stand above saving billions of people?
Well, because Cyclops is... No, because Co-Seer's like, oh, well, if you don't kill the Emperor, then, like, he's gonna end up killing billions of people. So it's up... Like, that's your choice to make. If you don't kill him, then you're essentially killing billions of innocent people.
Right. And then Cyclops also has a more interesting point. He says, instead of just being, like, a goody-two-shoes moralist, he says... you know, it's like, you're risking putting the crystal in his hands all because you want revenge for Deken killing your wife. Is one woman worth that risk? And Co-Seer romantically mumbles to himself, for me it was, and he walks. So right. A lot of
very
tortured
X-Men-y moment.
Right, yeah. The space soap opera continues.
Yeah.
And now the X-Men, they're trying to chase down the Starjammer ship through hyperspace, I guess, and they can't quite catch it. It's kind of funny to see. I guess you see the Starjammer in their view screen, and they just can't quite reach it. Mm-hmm. And the X-Men are killing time. Gambit's throwing playing cards into a Shi'ar space helmet, and Wolverine doesn't like this. He kicks the helmet, and that is just a little funny scene. Mm. And then Jean casually mentions to Lilandra, I guess, that every time I use my powers, I grow stronger, which is, I guess, good to note.
Right. That was a little exposition for the audience there, which it wouldn't be apparent if she didn't say it, because...
She seems to pass out again every time she uses her powers.
Right.
In classic
which
Jean.
Which makes me wonder... Yeah, I'm like, is it because it's Jean? Because like, the Phoenix
sucks.
Really could have chosen a little bit better, maybe, but...
Right. It's funny you mention that, because in the comics, Jean doesn't become the only, like, Phoenix Force. Other characters get the Phoenix power. At first, it makes more sense. It's like her daughter from an alternate timeline, Rachel Summers, becomes the Phoenix.
Yeah.
And then, like, but then more bizarrely, other mutants get it. I think, like, Cyclops gets the Phoenix Force at one point, which is insane. I never read those issues, but I've read about it.
Yeah.
So the Phoenix Force gets a little more, like... less choosy. It's not just all about Jean all the time.
Right, okay.
So, but... right, so it's like, we don't know if it's Jean here just being classic Jean or, like, what's going on. But she does say she is growing more powerful.
Yep.
And so, in the meantime, this is when Hezbollah kisses Corsair because he's about to go off and give the crystal to Ken and enact his assassination plan. Cyclops, in the meantime, reluctantly agrees. He says, what choice do I have? I have to save the galaxy if I just have to kill one man.
Yeah.
It's actually, you know, I get it that Cyclops is really noble and moralistic, but at the same time, you think he'd be all about killing this Ken guy and be a little more excited about it, you know.
He doesn't want to kill. He's an X-Man.
Yeah, I guess. But still, I mean, this guy is, like, he's Space Hitler. So.
Yeah, right.
So that's what's going on there. The crystal, they arrive at the crystal exchange. Co-Seer is, like, prompting Cyclops to kill Deken, but he's hesitating. But he doesn't have to worry about it because the Phoenix arrives just in time. And then Co-Seer tackles the Emperor, or who he thinks is the Emperor. Turns out it's a shapeshifter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the X-Men arrive with the Phoenix. She transports them all to the Emperor's station, wherever that is. And then they get into a big fight with the Imperial Guard.
Right. And the Imperial Guard is another group of, like, aliens.
Superheroes.
Yeah, alien superheroes, basically.
What's interesting about them, even though they're fighting for the Emperor, they're not necessarily on the Emperor's side, politically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
They're just his, like, army or something.
Right, like, so that's their job.
Yeah, they have to follow the Emperor's rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so that adds, like, an interesting element to them. They're not, like, they're not evil.
Right.
But the X-Men and the Imperial Guard fight. Don't ask me to name all the Imperial Guard members. I can't. They're all really cool looking, though, with different powers. There's, like, one guy who can grow into, like, a giant, like, sort of like
Ant-Man.
Right, like Ant-Man. There's another woman who's got, like, this cool, like, cape that shoots, like, energy out of it.
Mm.
There's another weird red alien lady with a whip. And she's, like, whipping the X-Men. And there's, like, another guy who's in a robot suit doing things.
Yeah.
So there's many characters all tussling about, and I really like the whip character.
Why?
I don't know. Because it just always makes me think of this completely stupid Bill Murray SNL sketch from the 80s when he was a guest star, and he played this character called the Whipmaster, and it was like a parody of, like, dumb, like, 70s TV shows. through the prism of 80s comedy, which I know is weird to say. Uh-huh. Anyway, so it's all about Bill Murray as this guy. His whole special characteristic is that he has a whip, and he's, like, really good at using a whip. Uh-huh. But it turns out in the sketch he's really bad at it.
Oh.
So he walks into a saloon, and he's just, like, whipping things. He's like, give me a whiskey. And the bartender's like, here, come and get it. He's like, I don't have to come and get it when I can whip it to myself. He starts whipping at the whiskey glass. And in the meantime, it's just whipping people in the face. And everyone's getting, like, bloody noses. And then he just knocks over all the glasses with the whip. And then he eventually just drags it over with his whip. It's so stupid. So I always think about the whip master. I don't know, it's, like, totally insane. Anyway, there's going to be, like, two people who know what I'm talking about. So we have the Whipmaster lady, but in the midst of this fight, I feel like Rogue does a lot of the beating up here.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
That was a good choice to bring Rogue on this mission.
Right, yeah, Rogue's really strong. Like, she manages to beat up Gladiator, who, even though has the strength of Superman...
Yeah.
You know, Rogue is also sort of similar to Superman in a way, in the sense that she just flies without, like, any, like, wings or anything.
Yeah.
And she's super strong.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no way Rogue's as powerful as Superman. And it's implied that Gladiator is as powerful as Superman. So it's surprising when she punches him.
Yeah, right.
What I'm saying. Yeah. And then she also deals with the Whip Lady. She uses the whip herself and becomes the Whip Master.
Right. And then at some point there's like a door like coming down from the ceiling that's going to like block them off.
A really heavy iron gate.
Beast is like trying to hold it up and Wolverine comes and tries to help him.
And they're
the
really
two of them
struggling.
Are like buckling under the pressure of this thing. And Rogue is just like, I got it, guys. And she like lifts it all the way up so they can get out. It's like, wow, Rogue is stronger than Wolverine and Beast
together. Yeah, definitely. She's really useful on this mission, as you said. So, but, you know, this fight is all for naught. It's a big waste of time because the Emperor has the crystal and he starts invoking its power. Now, I didn't write down the full quote, but, like, I wrote down some of it. I think it's really cool what he says to open up the crystal. He says, in the name of Shara, and the Key 3, and the 9 dying stars, I invoke the power of the crystal. I think he also says some other stuff, too.
Yeah, it was kind of long.
But it's also, again, this crystal is, like, totally stupid. Like, how could it be accessible just by chanting a few things? Like, why could it be opened up?
Yeah, well, but it's also something about it's in their family line because they're, like, the ruling... family, so maybe, like, the right person has to say it or something.
Right, yeah, that might have to. But still, like, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like there's anything that special about these Shi'ar people. I mean, yeah, Lilandra has psychic powers, but whatever. I mean, other people in the galaxy have psychic powers. Doesn't mean that they can open an ancient crystal that controls the force of the galaxy.
Right.
So, you know, it also... If what you're saying is true, it lends credence to this idea that the Shi'ar genetic makeup is so... It's not just arbitrary. It's not just like they're royal because they took over the galaxy. It's because they...
It's like they took over the galaxy because they had some certain...
Right, they have something in their blood.
Power or something.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, that's possible because it's, again, it's, you know...
Mutants in space.
Yeah, X-Men in space, Star Trek, you know, it's just because... But still, it's just, like, bizarre that he could just say a few words and this insanely powerful artifact of the cosmos can be breached.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jean here remarks, so now we get a little bit more detail on the crystal. She says, the crystal's been breached and it has the power of a negative galaxy inside. And Wolverine's like, oh no, everything's gonna get, it's gonna get sucked out into here. He's like, no, everything is gonna get sucked in there.
Right, so the whole galaxy might get... sucked into this crystal.
Right.
If
into the negative galaxy.
Successful.
See, you know, this is what I... So when she mentions that it's a negative galaxy, I first understood it's like, oh, that makes sense. So the crystal's this thing. It's like the inverse of our galaxy.
Uh-huh.
It's absorbed all the light, and it's making, like, this polar opposite force. And maybe the whole point of the crystal is that the crystal has... That forever... It has to contain... like the opposite of existence to balance out the scales, and it's conveniently put in a crystal so that this opposite force, which is destructive, is like contained.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's not how it sounds now.
Yeah.
Now it's like the crystal contains the space and the capacity, the energy capacity to hold the whole contents of our
galaxy. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So... I don't know.
It's a void right now, and it's looking to be filled by our galaxy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so Daken has breached this void, and in doing so, he's, let's just say, temporarily given immense, like, infinite power.
Right.
So that's what he's been after the whole time. That's why he's obsessed with this crystal.
Right. I mean, Jean, like, summons the phoenix power and tries to stop him, but she's too late, and he, like, blasts her off, and she's like, oh, I wasn't strong enough yet. So now, if Jean knows that every time she uses the phoenix power, it makes her a little bit stronger, mm-hmm. why is she not just constantly using the phoenix power, regenerating her energy, using the phoenix power? So, because she knows this moment is coming. She should be prepared.
Because
this
is the confusing contradiction of it. Because even though she says she gets stronger every time, she's also weakened temporarily.
Yeah.
So she can't, like, do much after she does something crazy like transport the X-Men through hyperspace to where the Emperor is.
Yeah, okay.
So she needs a little recharge, but every time she recharges, she gets more power. Something's bizarre going on there.
Yeah.
It's also not quite, like, explained. There's this crystal, and then there's the Phoenix, which is the guardian of the crystal.
Yeah.
Who is, like, setting up all these parameters? Like, where does the Phoenix Force come from?
Ancient, you know, mystical powers.
Right. I think the Phoenix Force is, like, one of these, like, natural cosmic forces that exist in the Marvel cosmology world.
Okay.
Much like Galactus and, like, with the other, like, insane gods living in the Marvel world, where they're not so much, like, characters, they're forces of nature.
Right.
So I think that's what the Phoenix is, although the explanation's a bit wonky because, like, why is it all tied in with these Shi'ar people? It seems a little more pedestrian than it does cosmic. Although, I'm sure there's an answer for that. Someone in our Facebook group can let us know. But that is pretty much the conclusion of this episode. Sonia, do you think the X-Men will save the day?
Yes, we have a couple seasons to go.
You don't think they're all going to take place in the Negative Galaxy?
Maybe they will.
You know, one last question I have is, it seems like this Emperor Daken guy already has a lot of power. He's the unquestioned ruler of the Shi'ar galaxy.
Yeah.
You know, he controls a galaxy. That's no easy feat, as we've seen in Star Wars. You know, the Emperor has trouble controlling a galaxy, as does the Republic.
Right.
You know, controlling the galaxy is no easy thing. Like, there's hundreds of billions of stars and presumably trillions of planets. You know, trillions and trillions of people in a galaxy. So, you know, good for the Emperor. That's, like, what a feat. You've done it. You know?
Yeah.
You own a galaxy. That's a nice, like, feather in your cap. Like, what, like, why is he seeking extra power? Like, why would he think that he needs more power?
Well, that's what makes him a villain by definition, is because he's greedy and power hungry and, like, he'll stop at nothing.
It just seems that, it's just confusing because it just seems that his power already has no limit. That's my only point about it. It's like, he already, you know.
Do we see him actually use any, like, supernatural powers?
No, we don't.
Before the Emkron crystal?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, maybe he's jealous because little Andra's
she's a psychic.
Got psychic powers and he got nothing.
Right, yeah.
And he's trying to
overcompensate. He's just the Emperor of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps you're right. That's a good motivation. And again, there probably is a real explanation for that. But anyway,
yep, totally made it up.
We're more our X-Men fandom is more, like I said, limited to the original continuity of the X-Men comics that stretched, like, through the early 2000s at its, like, limit, and more focused on this show. We don't dive quite as deep into the, like, every spin-off X-Men comic and subsequent explanation for all these things. So that's why we rely on our fans in the X-Men Tass Facebook group.
To stop us from wildly speculating.
Yes. So please join us there at the X-Men Tass Podcast Facebook group. You're free to join, talk to us, yell at us, answer all our ridiculous questions. Follow me on Twitter, at Willie Simpson. Follow at X-Men Tass, the writers of the X-Men show, Eric and Julia Leewald. They're friends of ours. Their book is coming out very soon. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the entire back history of this show, which we're all going to get and we're going to talk about one day.
Super exciting.
It's called Previously on X-Men, so we're going to start plugging that more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone look forward to that. Also, make sure to subscribe to us wherever you subscribe to podcasts. If you happen to be an Apple iTunes user, please leave a review, 5 stars. It goes a long way to increasing our visibility, which, as we said, seems more important as Apple upgraded their iTunes layout and, like, stuff is way, I wouldn't say it's harder to find, but
You get buried faster.
Yeah, we were buried a little more than we'd like to be. we are an honest podcast, so we'll tell you we're pretty obscure right now. Although our fan base does continue to grow. I will say, in a fit of self-promotion, that the last 2 weeks have been our most downloaded weeks ever.
Yeah, thanks so, everybody
yeah,
out there.
Yeah, thank you very much. So that's as far as I've got in terms of plugs. We will conclude Phoenix Month next week. When we return, Sonia, do you have any final words before we reach this thrilling conclusion?
Phoenix in space.
Around Halloween. Wait, is that connected somehow? Probably not.
Coincidence.
But happy Halloween, everybody. And we'll see you next week.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.